The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Well, you know, I have to say, I'm pretty excited that, you know, we've got this fasting guide that's out and that's released. And, you know, I remember when we first started Justin's journey and we were going through his nutrition, he was running through the nutrition guide and utilizing that to get it going. And then when we made it to his phases where we started kicking in the fasting guide, this became like probably one of his go-to. Wouldn't you say that, Justin? Wouldn't you say it's your go-to, like, you know, your methods?
That was totally my recipe. I mean, once I started to follow specific methods, you know, some of them being lean gains, some of them being warrior style, like a little bit of a hybrid of the two. I just for me personally and my body type, and I really was responding well to that. And so that was something that I was excited about and I wanted to share with people.
Well, guys, we just released all these programs that I think Adam's going to talk about, but we just released them all like 4 hours ago and we've sold some already.
Yeah.
Like people are already buying these programs and we're already getting, you know, awesome reviews. So what's up, Adam? What are we doing? Are we gonna keep it going?
Yeah, no, I think we've got Doug convinced to at least run this for at least a couple more.
I don't think he has a choice.
Yeah, I think we've convinced him. I know he's not happy about how cheap we went and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I mean, here's my thing, and I don't know if you guys are on the same page as me, but my ultimate goal and vision is, and let's keep it real. One of the things we've always done in this show is we've always kept things very, very straightforward and real. At the end of the day, all this shit costs money and costs time for us. So we have to make some sort of a money for everything that's going to get produced. But at one point, if we get enough momentum, my goal is always to continue to give more and more for less and less and less.
We give the ultimate bundle of everything.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. I mean, I hope that like it becomes a one-stop shop as far as being able to help somebody and you feel like you get so much great information for such a, almost like it'd be silly not to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you've got the MAPS Anabolic full body workout program, right? That's got the phased workouts, blueprints. It's got video demos where I'm actually breaking down exercises, teaching you how to do them properly, not just doing it and you watch, but I'm actually explaining things. Then you have the No BS six-pack formula, which is the workout specifically for your abs. It's designed to give you a six-pack. Again, it's phased workouts, got trigger sessions, video demos. Then there's the nutrition survival guide, which, by the way, version 2, updated version, will be coming out, which you'll get for free by enrolling in this package. So you get version 1, but you get version 2 as soon as it comes out for free. Then we have the intermittent fasting or the fasting survival guide, which talks about fasting. This, all of these things together were like, 200. Doug was going to try and sell them like $248 or something ridiculous like that. $97.
It's a steal. That's it. Let me describe it like this, okay? All these things, think of having like the most badass trainers wherever you live curate everything for you, right? Everything from like how to get lean and shredded and strong, doing that with exercises, but also with nutrition.
And on top of that, imagine if they're the most handsome trainers you've ever seen in your life.
Absolutely.
You've got trainers that are awesome and handsome.
Well, I mean,
it's a crazy
think about all the hours and time that it's taken just to develop everything we've done, everything from man hours to like the developing it and putting it together to where it's actually very nice and professional. And think of that, and then think of what we charge for 1 hour of our time to personal train somebody, and to be able to
more than that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I'm saying, is to be able to give all this information for a price that's even less than what a single hour would be. And there's no way I could cover one of those. Like, so if I was just going over the MAPS Anabolic program, it would take me more than an hour just to explain the entire program. Just to talk about it and explain it, much less all the other programs that are coming with it. It's like, dude, that's...
Well, look here, $97 is less than a lot of people spend on supplements. And I'll tell you something right now, there isn't a $97 supplement out there that will give you even close to what you're going to get with this.
Yeah, don't buy any supplements.
And do this.
Just do this.
And then you have, you know, we broke it down for students who have issues, you know, spending, you know, investing $97 up front. So we give them an option to pay 3 payments of $43, which is like a gym membership fee for 3 months. That's it. Lifetime access to our private forum.
By the way, I don't want to interrupt you, which I am. I just think this is important.
That's what we do.
I think this is important to know because everybody's like, oh, okay, that's cool. You get a guy for this. Oh, that's cool. I don't know how many people now have told me that the price that the bundle cost is worth just the forum access.
Oh, we're on there answering questions.
Just to be on a community of all these people going through the program and have access to us personally to where we can communicate back and forth and answer questions, that in itself is valuable. So we always like, oh yeah, and oh, by the way, you get this forum for free, but the value of that is ridiculous.
And one thing we do very, very well, especially Justin, he puts his mouth where his money is. So you thought I was going to say something else.
Oh, yeah.
He puts his mouth where his money is. And so literally, you enroll in this program and you try it for a month. If in that month, I'm telling you right now, this is my word, if this program isn't the best thing you've ever seen, if you're not like, if you don't look at it and say to yourself, this is worth way more than I invested, then return it. We'll give you your money back. That's a 30-day money back guarantee, which is unheard of for this kind of value. You go to mindpumpradio.com. You click on the big yellow button. It shows you everything. It breaks it down for you. Enroll now before the shit goes away, because I'm telling you right now, Doug's itching to take the shit away like he did last time. And he's either itching because of that or because of that, because of herpes. One of those two things is causing.
I thought it was crabs.
Or both. Crabs. Yeah. Both of them. Because herpes have crabs.
Yeah.
Mindpumpradio.com. Big yellow button. Do it.
Enroll.
If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
Welcome back to Mind Pump. This is the only podcast in the world that has won 4 Emmys, 2 Tonys, a Pulitzer Prize, and a Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, shit.
Wow.
Bro.
I'm most impressed with the Tonys.
We won all that shit because we're so awesome. And we never lie, except for right now. I just made all that shit up.
Yeah.
I was going
to
say.
I have to say that.
That would have been so cool.
Because it sounds realistic. Like, if you listen to the show and I said all that, you're probably thinking to yourself, oh, yeah, of course. Of course they want to pull it.
I could see that. I could see that.
And so I have to make sure I tell
it's
the audience.
It's just a matter of time.
I have to make sure to tell the audience we're a new show. We did not win all those awards. I was totally lying at that time.
Yeah.
Q&A.
Who are you here with?
Mm-hmm.
I'm here with myself. Who are you here? I'm just kidding. I'm here with Adam Schaefer.
Woo woo.
Justin Andrews.
Yeah, yeah.
And Douglas Eggy.
Yes, sir.
Question and answer time, guys.
Q&A.
I love these.
This is one of my favorite things for us.
They require the least amount of prep.
Which is like zero.
That's why it's funny. It's funny because we don't prep at all for anything. And then this requires even less than that. So
yeah.
It requires Doug to write the questions on the whiteboard.
Yeah. God damn, Doug.
I imagine it's kind of like Tosh.0, right? Where he gets all his content from the internet and then it's just like, hey, let's roll a show.
Do you think they do that? I was curious about that. Do you think that like Tosh and what's the other one now? Ridiculousness with
yeah.
Do you think they let those guys go freestyle where they like say,
well,
okay,
they obviously have a staff that drums up all this content.
Of course.
Right? So then they probably present it to them. Oh yeah, that's cool. Oh, that's stupid. And then they just spin off a little like skit to go off of that. So
I'm curious.
But he does it. He's brilliant with it.
Well, spontaneity. You can hear it.
Yeah.
You know, you can hear like if we sat and actually planned a lot, I don't think we'd sound as good.
No, we'd be too formulaic.
Well, and I think I just think I don't know if it's the generations now or what, and just with social media and the connectability that the abilities that we have that we didn't have 20 years ago. Now there's this new, before you wanted to be entertained, right? Like, and whether it was real or not real, it didn't matter as much. Where now I feel like people are always in search of the more real, the more realistic. I mean, look at even reality TV, which a lot of that is fake bullshit, you know, is that why people are drawn to that is it's closer to reality for them than a show that was scripted and written, right?
Of course. And this is the reason why we don't prep. Okay.
Yeah.
That's not because we're lazy.
Not because we're lazy and we don't and because we're disorganized. It's because we do it to make the show better.
Right. It's part of the chemistry.
It's for you.
Yes.
Yeah. We all have really good chemistry.
We do. Oh yeah. And it smells great.
So
too.
Let's kick this off. What do we start with? Last time you went from bottom to top, top to bottom. We're gonna start in the middle and go around. What are you gonna do here?
We'll start with the first one because I think this is gonna be a quick one.
Okay.
This is from Andre_Drog. His question is. So he's questioning Adam. He gives Adam a compliment on the fullness of his pecs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, sir.
You've got very nice full breastises.
Can I just say that was...
very milk-producing.
I think we've talked before on one of a podcast that was one of my weak points, big time.
Uh-huh. Strength-wise, or you just didn't have a lot of muscle
both.
There? Really?
Both strength, and I had no chest. I had like one of those concave chests as a kid growing up. Like, in fact, I remember my two buddies that we used to work out in their garage when we first started. They used to have the penny and the pencil test. You know, they could squeeze their chest together and hold like a penny.
Can you put on your lipstick like that?
Yeah, I couldn't do that, dude. So they always teased me and made fun of me, and I couldn't even put up the bar back then. So chest was definitely something I struggled with for a long time.
You've got nice pectorals
and
now.
A lot of that, before we get into completely answering this question, personally, a lot of it was biomechanics. Now, and I find this...
Yeah, because his question was, after he gave you a compliment, was, you know, what order of work exercises, or what's your technique for getting around full chest?
So, the myths that are out there... are, you know,
work my lower part.
Yeah, exactly.
Work my
targeting
more in the armpit,
specific parts of a muscle. We can't isolate a muscle, period. Our bodies work synergistically, and multiple muscles are working antagonist and protagonist in every movement
simultaneously.
So, yes, it's impossible. So it's impossible to isolate a muscle. It's even more impossible to isolate a part of a muscle. So when the pectoralis major is being flexed and contracted and working, the entire thing is being worked, no matter what plane you are in. Now, does it target more areas, or is there more stress put in different areas by different exercises? Absolutely. And should your workouts vary because of that? Absolutely. But if I could go back and say what was one of the biggest difference makers for me on my chest size and growth, there's been multiple things, and one of those was definitely just really focusing on my biomechanics, especially with chest. So we do everything in our front, right? Nobody walks around and does anything with their hands behind their back. You don't drive that way. You drive in front of you. Drive everything in the sagittal plane, right? So because of that, it tends to people have what's called upper cross syndrome. You have naturally rounded forward shoulders just because we do everything in front of us. So when you think about all the hours in the day that you're brushing your teeth,
reaching forward,
it's gonna curve and round the body that way naturally. So we actually have to do work inside the gym to work against that in order to have this neutral spine alignment. And why I'm getting into all this and starting to sound like Sal right now a little bit, and I try not to do that, is that
God forbid.
I wouldn't want people to start thinking I'm intelligent or anything. So what you have to do is you have to have your shoulders in a retracted position in order to truly fully engage the chest. Otherwise, a lot of your deltoid has to do a lot of the work through the range of motion. And so learning to get yourself into that fully retracted position to put a lot of the focus on the chest. And a lot of people don't realize that 60% of working out is actually mental. So having that mind-muscle connection of really learning to fire that muscle while you're performing an exercise versus what happens to a lot of us, especially when we're young guys trying to develop our physique, is, you know, like I was a victim of this, is, you know, my answer was just to keep increasing weight, or, you know, hey, let's do a wide grip to a close grip. And my biomechanics on both of those were not ideal. So I would be better off focusing on my biomechanics on one of those movements and actually learning to engage the chest more and perform the exercise more properly. And I'll get more benefits as far as chest gains than me doing all these crazy variations improperly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, two things I want to touch on what you just said. So number one, here's a little quick tip if you want to know, if you're trying to figure out if you can isolate a part of a muscle, you have to look at the two points of attachment. So a muscle will attach in two general areas, because as it contracts, it pulls those two areas together, right? So a bicep's an easy one to think of. When it contracts, it brings my hand up closer to my shoulder. Well, with the pecs, bring the top of your arm more towards the midline of your body. They call it horizontal adduction. The chest has a long... If you look at your sternum, your chest attaches along the sternum and up into the clavicle. So theoretically, you can work more upper and lower chest with certain exercises. Now, you can't do this with, say, a bicep, where the attachments are so close to each other that it doesn't matter. I can move my hands in different positions. I'm not going to work the outer and the inner bicep that much more to cause significant difference. But with chest, theoretically you can, because it's got that big attachment down the sternum. But the second thing I want to talk, so this has to do with all muscles, but the second thing I want to talk about, he talked about retracting the shoulder girdle. So in layman's terms, that means pinching your shoulder blades back and then doing your chest press exercises. Some of the best form you'll ever learn for chest exercises are from strength athletes, power lifters. Because power lifters, and I'm not talking about assisted lifters with the bench shirts and stuff like that. Look at the lifters that do raw competitions. Mm-hmm. They maximize their biomechanics to lift as much weight as possible. And the way you do that is when you're on a bench, you have an arch in your lower back. That doesn't mean your butt is off the bench. That means your lower back is not on the bench. You don't want your lower back flat. If you flatten your lower back, it throws your shoulder forward and you round your shoulders. And like what Adam was saying, you use more delts. But worse than that, you actually put your shoulder joint in a position that can lead to impingement, to lead to issues with your acromioclavicular joint. You get lots of shoulder problems. So you want to pinch your shoulder blades back and down. You want your lower back arch, but your butt on the bench. That's the position you bench from. And you also, here's another thing, you also want to use your legs to drive into the floor. Not lift your hips, but you want to activate your legs, because this activates your central nervous system a little better, and you'll actually get a better contraction in the prime movers. And for those people who are trying to understand what I'm talking about, if you were to grip something and squeeze it as hard as you could, but relax the rest of your body at the same time, you wouldn't be able to squeeze it as hard as if you tensed up your whole body. As a matter of fact, this happens naturally.
The best example, that's like gymnastics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So doing like a simple movement, but they have like that ability to really contract their entire body at one given moment of time. And so that's that force strength that they can tap into neuromuscularly.
Definitely. And then when it comes to chest exercises, what works best for you? We have general exercises that tend to work best. However, individual variances are huge. Okay. Yeah. So I know some people who, when they bench press, they just don't get very much in their chest.
Yeah.
So they have to, they're better off with dumbbells or with an incline. So you're going to have to kind of, figure that out.
Sometimes you need to work on you need to work on strength in your rhomboids. You need to get that balance correct.
Right.
And so
that retraction.
We discussed this one time, and I think it was online on podcast. I'm not sure. But there was a study that was done recently that I thought was very interesting. We talked about it regarding glutes, but it works here also, in the fact that it's important to note what Sal was just saying about variation. Of course, is important, varying your workouts, but also and no one will know better than yourself what exercises you feel your chest activated the most at. And everyone will be uniquely different. Some people do a flat bench press and get this amazing pump from it, because they can actually activate the chest. They can stack it heavier than anything else they do. Some people need to be on like a fly machine, where it's which is typically like Sal said too, is the adduction of the humerus and the horizontal plane is technically what a chest fly is on, like a pec deck machine or whatever. So that movement is the ideal movement for the pectoris major, as far as getting as close to isolation as possible. So some people need to do an exercise like that in order to feel it. So learning what exercises you activate your chest the most is definitely something that should be incorporated in that. And then honestly, one of the things I was going to say that made a big difference in my chest gains is volume, is just getting back to volume. If it's a lagging body part for you,
work it more.
It should be addressed that way. And that's typically how I attack every. I mean, I used to have, and it's, I love it. I love picking a weakness on my body and then is busting my ass to develop it as a strength. I remember when the first time somebody had made a comment, it was actually a female bodybuilder, and I was about 23 years old, and I asked her to assess my physique, like, what did I need to work on? And she totally tore my shoulders apart. She said, I have weak ass shoulders, and back then I used to always relate my shoulders to my arms. I had great arms, because I had a big buys and tries. But I had like this sloping look. I just had all buys and tries. Like my buys and tries over dominated my deltoids. And it like it broke my heart in a sense, but then it also changed the way I trained them, you know. And at that time, I used to always throw. My attitude was this as a trainer: oh, I'm doing chest, so I'm getting a little front delt work, so I'll do a little bit more shoulder stuff, and then call that shoulders and chest that day. Or oh, I was doing back, and I got a lot of rear delt work because I'm doing back, and so I'd throw a little bit of extra. And that's how I treated my shoulders, was they get touched a little bit with where when it became an emphasis for me. It became that there would be an entire workout that was dedicated to my shoulders. And then in addition to that, I would still add in these other days where I'd be touching. So I'm just increasing the volume dramatically. And, you know, Sal talks to this a lot about the difference between recovery and adaptation. And, you know, all I'm teaching my body is adapt to a lot more volume, and it will grow and it'll show change. So when you have a weak area, you know, and when you people talk about the shape of something, like the roundness of somebody, the flatter, the squareness of a chest. Like some guys have those blocky square chests. Some have those cupped looking, you know, chests. Like just that part is a lot of that's genetic, the way someone's just their genetic makeup. But, you know, we can all create a better chest, a fuller chest, you know, a larger muscle. And quite frankly, the best thing you could possibly do, number one, work on form and technique. Two, increase your volume, and then completely continue to vary your workouts. You know, you asked a question about wide grip, close grip, absolutely do it all. You know what I'm saying? Do not neglect, but do not be fooled that there is a single one exercise that's going to help develop the roundness in your chest.
Beautiful. Next question. By the way, you sounded really smart.
Fuck.
And you were saying,
I did not
mean to. Are you taking those pills?
He hasn't even tried them.
I'm
about to give you credit there.
All right. So the next question is from the Sean P22. This is a good question. When, as entrepreneurs, because we're all self-employed entrepreneurs and we have been for a while, when did we get that aha moment, you know, where we decided, like, okay, I need to do this. I need to work for myself.
Oh, wow.
So I can start. I started my first. Well, I mean, I had my first business, you know, when I was a kid, when I was like 14, I'd mow lawns and stuff. But when I really legitimately had my first business, I was 22. And the aha moment for me, it's tough to say because I've always known that I was going to work for myself. I could never look into the future and think to myself I would be working for a corporation or a company. I've always thought like I had to have my own thing. So it's really a tough thing. I don't know. It might be different. I don't know when we ask the other guys.
Oh, yeah. Mine's different for sure.
See what theirs is. But for me, it was like I've always known I was going to do my own thing. It just never – I was never motivated by working for someone else. I did a good job when I did, and I always like to perform. But when I would think about my future, I was always doing my own thing. And so I didn't have a fear of – you know, the risks involved with doing it. That kind of stuff kind of turns me on. Or the fact that I wouldn't make any money at all for a while. Because as an entrepreneur, you tend to make shit when you first start off. And those of us that succeed tend to just drive through it. Whereas other people are like, oh my God, I got to go get a job because I can't handle not making X amount of dollars. So, that's kind of my story. I just decided I wanted to do it. And I thought about all the difficulties and the challenges. And they did scare me, but at the same time, they turned me on. So I did it. How about you, Big J? Super JJ?
Yeah, for me, I guess after college, I had really no idea what I was going to do as far as career goes. I knew that I liked, I liked working out. I liked training. I liked business. And so I was actually thinking I was going to get into some kind of a business job. And so I actually started out trying to get into sports marketing, and that was the direction I was going to start going. And I just didn't like it because it was very, very corporate, and there was all these structures in place that were like...
Yeah, we don't like rules.
I just don't like it. I've never liked the rules, and I've never did well having a very linear path for me to follow. And so I went... I got into training in the corporate world, and then... I excelled and I made, you know, best of it, and went even like when I was a bartender or like a server, like I got to a point where I would always get up to about that management spot, right? And I just found out that I was the best and most efficient at what I was doing. And I just got frustrated with how everybody else did it. And I'm like, I just got tired of like trying to understand what was going on in these other people's minds and why they weren't working as hard as me. And so I just, from that aspect, and then the same thing happened when I was in training. I got up to that management spot and I'm like, okay, why aren't people doing this? This is part of the job. I just don't understand it, because it's a job I take seriously. A job is a job, and you know, I'm going to work my ass off. And then I just realized, I'm like, look, I'm very good at what I'm doing. I don't know what the hell you're doing, but I would do great by myself. Mm-hmm. And so that's like, hey, I'm out of here. I'm doing it myself. And then boom, it was like so eye-opening. It was like, oh my God, I am determining my own fate. I'm kicking ass and it's all mine. Right. You know, I don't have to give this away to somebody else. You know, I mean, obviously it's 10 times harder. Because marketing is another huge piece that you have to learn, and you got to learn quickly, because otherwise you're not going to make money. And I feel like that added bit of pressure, though, has always helped me to exceed and to help get to where I want to be. So I feel like, yeah, my aha moment. And that's the other thing, too, is like Adam talks a lot about, like, you know, having this leadership mentality and always like kind of growing up with that. Well, for me, it's always been, you know, there's different types of leadership. And for me, leadership is leading by example. And so I've always taken that by the rein, like, hey, look at me. I'm going to do this to the best of my ability. And either you see, you know, I set that example. If you're not going to meet that example, you know, you're going to fall behind. And, you know, it's either you come onto my ship or you jump off. That's it.
Hardcore.
Yeah.
What about you, Adam?
So I went through Justin and I shared a little bit of stuff in common here. I'm probably more like Justin than Sal. But I mean, my first bit of money or check I ever received was entrepreneur. So I started even at 15 years old. My first business was, you know, mowing lawns. And we've talked, I don't want to go into all the things I've done. So I've done a ton of stuff. Now, I always did it not because I had like this, back then had this huge passion for entrepreneurship. It was because I was very money driven. You know, I'll just be very honest. Like, I didn't have a lot of nice things growing up. We weren't well off whatsoever, and I wanted nice things. I wanted a nice car. I wanted a nice house one day. I wanted nice clothes, and I knew that if I was going to do that, I had to take control and do it myself. And at a young age, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities for you to make a ton of money. So entrepreneurship was a way that I could always do something on the side or find a way to make money. And I was always very creative in that sense and willing to work hard. And so that's kind of how it started. But I, like I said, I was not in love with it. At this point, I didn't think it was my future. In fact, when I was from 15 years old to 19 years old, this is when I worked at the dairy. And when I was at the ranch, you know, I basically was like the right hand man there. So I was with a family that owned this dairy where we had dairy, we had almonds, we had chickens, it was a farm, and it was completely privately owned by them. And that was their source of income. And I watched them struggle. You know, I watched them work 7 days a week. They could never take vacation. I mean, I was with this family for 4 years, and I was turned off by entrepreneurship. And I saw that and I thought, man, they didn't drive nice cars. They didn't have nice, super nice clothes. They worked their asses off to just make a living and get by. And I thought, man, that looks fucking tough and rough. And I don't want to do that. You know, I don't think I want to do my own business if it means I don't ever get a time off or anything like that. So I actually was really turned off by it. Fast forward a few years later, now I'm in my 20s. I'm working for a great company. I have 401k benefits, six figure employee, and now I'm getting this money that I enjoy. It wasn't until I got to my, and mind you, why I was doing this, because I've always been a very money motivated person. Even when I worked for 24, I was making good money. I always had side businesses and projects because I always had a knack, and I'm sure, and this is probably me still learning. So this isn't quite the aha moment yet. I'm still into entrepreneurship. I'm still doing different businesses on the side. But for me, it was always money motivated. It was always another source of income, and I was always trying to grow my income. And so about 25 years old, and this is probably going to sound a little arrogant, so I apologize. But my aha moment was when I would be in a meeting with my superiors. And by superiors, I mean like my boss's boss's boss. And I had felt like I could no longer learn from this man. And he was, you know, we're talking about people that were several levels above me, and I felt like I was as well read, as mature business wise, and I felt like they were holding me back. And when the moment that I felt like I couldn't grow anymore, I then felt, and I still stayed around longer. So this is 25 or so, and I stuck around all the way till my late 20s, still working for a company. And you know, a part of me was dying. And I realized that I thirsted for growth and knowledge. And I realized that if I worked for somebody else, I could allow that those people to slow me down. And although I still sought after my own books, my own knowledge, it made it difficult when I always had somebody above me that was holding back my strengths. And that was my aha moment. My aha moment when I was looking at somebody who was several pay grades ahead of me and thinking to myself, it could take me 10, 15 years just to get to his spot, just to know that I already know more than him. I don't want that anymore for myself. I want more. I want more, and I want to be let free to where I can continue to grow. So that was...
Beautiful. You gave me a boner.
Yeah.
That was my aha.
No glass ceiling, man.
Next question is from Thermoptic. That's a great name. Thoughts on intermittent fasting and warrior diet? Hey, we just released...
Hey, since you mentioned it...
We just released a fasting guide. So it breaks it all down and teaches you how to figure out the best way to utilize fasting. We're big fans of fasting. I do it probably more frequently than these guys do, but they both utilize it themselves. If you use it the right way, it boosts growth hormone levels, you burn body fat, you utilize protein better, tend to have more energy. It feels good.
Well, in the guide too, Justin, you discuss how we all utilize it in different ways too, or so, right?
Yeah. So I tried to add in, you know, a bit of our own experience with it, because we all have a variation of it, and I feel like that's the beauty of it. There's room for you to experiment and do self-experimentation. And so this really was like a very helpful tool for me. And so I'm not bullshitting you guys. This is one of the main things I use to start my cutting down, my leaning phase. And very helpful. And maybe not for everybody, maybe not. But guess what? You never know till you experiment. So
we've had a few people now comment on our page, on our Instagram page. And they'll say something like, I tried the fasting and I thought I was going to hate it. And I love it. I feel great and I'm getting leaner. And it's like people are so worried that they're going to fast and feel like shit.
That's it. Yeah. It's countercultural to some degree.
But for a lot of people, you don't. It's the opposite. Oh, I feel way better when I fast.
Yeah. Me too.
And I think that what you'll enjoy about the guide is, like Justin said, is that we all have a difference. We all take the science behind it, and we break down the science behind why it's effective and why it does work. And then we all talk about how, you know, we all have different either challenges with it or utilize it in different ways. And that's the great part about it is, you know, you get to read the guide. It's not just us saying like, oh yeah, we totally agree with warrior fasting, or oh yeah, we totally agree with this type of fasting. It's like, here's the science behind all of it. This is why it works. This is what are all the benefits. And then here's some of the challenges that you may come across. And these are different ways that we utilize it within our own nutrition diet.
And I can guarantee that the closer that you, basically put it together to mimic your own current lifestyle, the more success you're going to have with it, right?
Yeah, so, good point.
Yeah, so anything that's, well, you know, on this day, I really don't already, you know, eat, or, you know, you just sort of plan it out and look at your schedule, and then, you know, you optimize it. And this is just another way to read through, like, a lot of people's hard work and research that they've, you know, displayed for everybody to access. So
perfect.
Awesome.
All right. So I think we have time for one more question. This one's a doozy. This is from our girl, Rochelle, sugarsweet_and_fit. Question is about childhood obesity. Who is to blame?
I love that we have you guys. This is one of my topics I can get kind of off on a tangent about, and I have to be careful. Because being the single guy who has no kids, I lose always. Doesn't matter how smart I sound when I come off this way or whatever. I love having you two with children. So it's like you guys automatically, you know, because I think of us as a team when we answer questions like this. So now I feel like I could say I have kids, you know.
Well, before we get into this, I want to just real quick squash a myth, okay? Because I know what's gonna. I know some people are gonna be like, oh, you know, a lot of people have fat genetics, fat genes. If you go back, you can Google this yourself. You can Google, you know, circus fat man, you know, 1900, okay? You'll see pictures of early, you remember those circus freaks, right? They used to have circus acts, and then they'd have what they called the freaks, and they had the you know, the bearded lady and the fat, you know, the big fat guy, whatever. You look at a picture of the overweight guy that did was in the circus in the early 1900s.
Was he like 300 pounds, that's it? The dude, 200
could, he could walk around the streets right now and totally
blend in.
He wouldn't be that big of a deal. So, yes, there's genes involved with obesity, but we're talking 10, 15 pounds. We're not talking 50, 60, 80, 100 pounds. So, no, the childhood obesity epidemic is not due to genes. Okay. So I'll start and I'll tell you who's to blame straight up.
Before we get going here, can I piggyback off a little bit longer than that too? There's something to be said about somebody who puts on genetically that puts on body fat faster than somebody else, right? So that there is a difference in all of our genes. That same person, I'm willing to bet everything I have, also has an easier time building muscle, which can aid in your overall metabolism. So there's the grass is always greener on the other side.
It can be, and that tends to, that's speculative, but that, you know, I'd love it to see some studies on that.
It is speculative, and I know that.
But as trainers, we do realize that that tends to be the case, right?
Yeah, I mean, have you ever trained somebody who is considered themselves big boned or heavy, and then they have a hard time building?
Yeah, it's more, they're more likely to be able to build muscle easier. Definitely. I'll tell you right now who's to blame. It's their parents. 9 out of 10 times, if you see an overweight kid, you'll have overweight parents. So, you know, look, I got kids. My kids eat what I eat. That's just the bottom line. People are getting fatter. Parents are getting fatter. Their kids are going to get fatter. Guess who else is getting fatter? People's pets are getting fatter. Mm-hmm. This is a fact. Oh, yeah. There is an obesity epidemic among pets now. You ask any veterinarian. So it's just because, look, your kids are going to eat what you eat. So if you eat shitty, your kids are going to eat shitty. So stop trying to get
it's a modeling thing. And, totally. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I agree 100%. Where was I going to go with that? Yeah, like, so on top of that, God, I had this like great point. Come back to me.
Well, I'll tell you something that's funny that we just, Katrina and I just had this topic the other day. We talked about the pets. So our English bulldogs are extremely lazy, right? But they're big dogs. They're very muscular, and so they can handle quite a bit of food. But I actually regulate my dogs the same way I would regulate myself. And she doesn't, it took her a while to get it. You know what I'm saying? Because she would give me shit. She'd be like, are you feeding the dogs tonight? I'm like, no, they already ate this morning. And she's like, well, they got to eat again for tonight. I'm like, no, they literally, I didn't get a chance to walk them today. They were in their crates all day long. They haven't fucking moved. They're fine. Okay. They'll be fine till tomorrow. Yeah. They're not going to die. In fact, us feeding them now is just going to overfeed them, and they're just going to put on body fat. So they can handle it till tomorrow.
Here's the thing, okay? This is the point that might upset some people, but I feel like as not only is a modeling of eating the right way, but it's also creating boundaries, okay? Which I feel like some parents out there skirt around and they don't want to offend their kid. They want to befriend their kid and be buddy-buddy and not get any sort of resistance from them back, right? So this is where, you know, you see on some of these shows where kids just are humongous. And, you know, maybe it's a single parent. Maybe it's like something that's like there's a tragedy of some kind, but they want them to be happy, right? So this is a real psychological problem because they want their kids so much to be happy that they want them to have whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And this is an excess thing, right? Anytime you're giving them an excess, now we get this, you know, obesity that's going to come as a result. We're going to get, you know, these other psychological effects from that. It's really touchy because everybody has their own style of discipline. Everybody has their own way of educating kids and fostering them, bringing them up into the world. You know, I definitely have strong opinions personally on how I raise my kids and how I want them to treat other people and how I want them to, you know, look at food and you know, be a good person and be a contributing person to society and have a hard work ethic. And guess what? Like, hard work is just that. You know, it's hard work for parents to establish that. It's very hard work. You know, kids will resist you all the way through. And a lot of times, you know, with me personally, my kids, you know, they don't, they scream and yell. And this is like one of those things that has happened, you know, constantly battling food. Like, no, you're eating this. We're all eating this as a family. And the minute I give into that, you know, you start over again. Right. And so it's hard. You know, I'm just going to throw that out there. It's very hard. Not every kid is going to be like, yeah, vegetables. Yeah. You know, fruit. When you're, they're constantly bombarded with Fruit Loops and, you know, Frosted Flakes. They're going to their grandma's and they're eating cake. And you know what I'm saying? Like, you just don't, you have to realize that your control is limited. And so you give them enough of an idea of what, you know, how to properly eat and what's good. And then also, you know, to be somewhat loose, to let them experience it themselves, right? And like, have a better outlook on it. So it's tough. It's a balance, but at the same time, it's so important that you really establish that with your kids and you're on it.
Well, I'm just going to put this out there, but if you're a parent and you eat shitty, but you decide you're going to make your kids eat healthy, good luck.
Yeah, right.
It's not going to happen. So step number one is don't buy bad food. Don't even have it in your house.
Right.
And you yourself need to eat healthy because you're not going to get, you can't tell your kids to do something that you're not doing. It's like that parent that chain smokes and then tells your kids, don't smoke cigarettes, they're bad for you. Meanwhile, they're smoking cigarettes. You know what the statistics on that are? Like, the kids, something like 5 times more likely or 10 times more likely to smoke cigarettes because they grew up in a household where people smoke cigarettes. So this is a decision that you have to make with your kids, and you do got to be healthy about it. You know, I never tell my kids don't eat that ice cream because it's going to make you fat.
Can I say what you're
right?
I want to say what sounds good, because it's actually been one of the most impressionable things that you've ever shared for me, and I've already passed this on, and I think it's some of the best advice. So I'm going to rob his thunder right here. That he talks about, because it's brilliant. It's I've always thought about this too. Like, you know, hey, because I don't have kids yet. You know, when I have kids, what if I did get those kids? What if I got those kids that, like, they saw was the McDonald's commercials, and all their friends did that, and they just constantly were hounding me. How would I handle that? And I'm big on, like, communication, and I believe that I would teach my kids how to communicate properly at a very young age, and I wouldn't just be that parent who says no because I told you so. Like, how would I teach them? And Sal has his method that he utilizes that I think is so brilliant and so important, that how you do this without giving your child a complex, which is relating food to energy and how they feel versus it's going to make you fat.
Yeah, it's performance based.
Yes, exactly. Right. This is going to make you fat, son, or this is going to make you skinny if you eat like this, or eat like daddy if you want to look like daddy, or no, like taking the whole look and complexing completely out of it and talk about how the body will feel, you know. So, and this is, you know, your dad eats like this because it makes me feel good. It makes me feel strong and energetic, and I can run through my day, and I'm much smarter, and I can do this. And you start utilizing words like that with your kid versus, you know, fat or skinny and things like that, on how to create a complex with food versus, okay, I'm gonna educate them on how body relates to how they feel and perform. And what a powerful tool on explaining that. And I've already utilized that with, like, Katrina's little nephew and stuff like that, explaining to him.
It works. It's extremely effective. Yeah. I'll say to them, you know, and look, I'm not freaking a food Hitler. You know, we have ice cream at my house. It lasts a long time because my kids, I'll let them have it maybe once a week.
Yeah.
But when they do eat it, and there's times, look, your kids will do this too, you know, when they'll eat a little ice cream, whatever, they'll be like, oh, my tummy hurts. This, I love those opportunities to educate them. And I've done this. I've taken my son to my computer, and let me show you why you feel the way you do. Let me explain what happens when the body consumes too much sugar. Mm-hmm. And I show him, and I say, this is why your tummy hurts, or this is why you're tired, or this is why your sister's acting like a maniac right now.
Right, right.
It's because I gave her some ice cream and now she doesn't. And so these are things that happen. And what ends up happening now is I'll see my kids turn shit down.
Yes.
We'll be at a birthday party and someone will ask my son, you know, do you want some cake? And he'll say, well, I'll have a little bit.
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, why don't you want to have more? Well, because then I don't really feel good. And of course, the parents look at me like, oh, you know, yeah, what are you telling your kids? You're
this
giving
guy.
It's like, no.
No, I had the same thing that, like, what, and I know that, like, all this time put in and really making sure that, you know, where the priorities are. Like, my son he'd eat like cake at a party or something. You'd see him eat like 2 or 3 bites and he's like, okay, I'm good. And then he goes back to playing and he just leaves it, you know, and it's like, oh, sweet.
Exactly.
I totally want, because I want them to, you know, to experience it with everybody else, have a good time, you know, Halloween, you know, you're going to do it, have fun as a kid. But, you know, it's that whole excessiveness about it, right?
Right.
And trying to eliminate that mentality. It's like the whole cheat meal thing. And this, I'm going to say, this is probably one of the worst things I've heard, that's, I guess, a common thing some parents like to do. You know, have a candy night once a week.
Schedule it.
Yeah, scheduling a candy night, and then like this humongous like buffet of candy, like keep a bowl or something in the house, because
that's
crazy. The mentality is there that you know, well, I'm gonna limit it, and then I'm gonna let them, you know, sort of get it out of their system.
That's crazy.
Where meanwhile it creates this insano food complex, right? Right,
absolutely. I had a client from she was from Sweden, and they actually do in Sweden they have a day, Sunday is like candy day. And it's actually the only day like the kids are allowed any candy at all. And she says typically like in their family, they would give their kid, they get like one piece of candy is like their thing on Sunday. That's it. It's like a national thing that everybody does. I mean, obviously there's exceptions to the rule, of course, but it's a tradition that's been long going over there that they do that, which would probably explain too why they're obviously a lot healthier than what we are, you know.
Well, I think two things.
Every day is a candy day in the US.
Two things. We talked about complex, giving your kids a complex. A big part of that also is how you talk about yourself. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking, like if I'm at home, like here we talk on the show and I talk about, "Oh, I need to get leaner, I need to get it ripped, or I'm going to gain some body fat." I try not to as best as I could use those terms about myself, because then I know my children are going to...
They'll listen.
They're going to internalize that. So I'm not going to say things like, "Oh, I feel fat." You know, I'll say that to my wife. Like, I got to be careful what I say, you know, to my wife, even about myself, because I know my children are going to internalize that.
Right.
But that being said, I wanted to go, you know, just 2 minutes onto this in terms of, you know, if you go back 50 years and you look at the size of a soda,
mm-hmm.
At a Coke... It's half the size of...
The extra large is what a small is now.
Exactly. And so serving sizes have changed, and the government got behind a completely faulty concept of fat makes you fat, don't eat fat, and you won't get fat, which is false. And as a result, the average American eats less fat now, but eats far more refined carbohydrates and sugars. So if you're going to feed your kids... You know, and you, let's say you're going to have a few courses, and look, as an Italian, this is like sacrilege, because when we eat, you know, big Italian dinner, pasta comes first. But what you should do is feed your children the fats and proteins first, and then give them the starches last.
Right, because you satiate.
And they're going to be less likely to overeat the things that are going to cause things like insulin resistance as adults. And I'm going to tell you this right now. If you look at the statistics, okay, the most dangerous thing for your child growing up is not drugs. It's not sex. It's food. So spend your time on this and make this a big deal. You wouldn't do drugs in front of your kids. Don't eat shitty food in front of your kids either, because they're much more likely to die of obesity-related disease, long-term diseases, than they are of overdosing on a drug or anything like that. And that's just a statistical fact. So make that an important thing in your life. Don't just think food is, you know, it's not a big deal. It's harmless, because that's bullshit. Food is killing way more people in modern societies, especially in America, than anything else.
Oh.
So make that a big deal.
Yeah, I have to piggyback off what you just said, because I want to give somebody the analogy or a visual of what something like this could look like, and an example of what we would probably think is okay or a good meal that you would like. Okay, spaghetti has to be like one of the go-to meals like that parents make for their kids. And what it normally comes with spaghetti is some garlic or French bread or what that. So you got the French bread, you've got the pasta noodles, you got the pasta sauce, and then you have probably 2 to 4 ounces of whatever you use, whether it be ground beef, turkey, or sausage, whatever you use to put as far, and that's your dish. That is so lopsided on how that
backwards.
So backwards on what that kid should eat. Like, you're talking about loading 80% of that meal is carbohydrates, and then what, maybe 10% is protein and fat. Like, it's so small, it's so backward. The way that we've been taught, like when you go to a restaurant or you go places, is so backwards. Like, you have to really think outside the box.
Carbohydrates are a lot cheaper.
Exactly. That's exactly why it is that. And that's what people don't get.
That's the food pyramid in general.
Is that everything is geared towards what we have more volume of, and what's cheaper and easier to do, which that doesn't necessarily mean it's the what's best for your body, and your plate should look a total flip. When you look at your plate, when you look down at it, you should see a very large portion of protein and fat, and then a very minimal portion of carbohydrates, especially like your starchy carbs.
And a large portion
as much
of veggies.
Yes, yeah, as much veggies as you want. Yeah. You can go to town on those, but yes, like your veggie, protein, and fat should take up 90% of your plate, and then you should have this little tiny pie of whatever pasta or whatever bread or whatever choice of carbohydrate that you're choosing to pair with that meal. But it is, you know, plates are lopsided right now.
You know what? One thing I forget, also forcing your kids to finish their plate, clean their plate, eat everything. I grew up that way. That comes from a time when, you know, my parents grew up that way. That came from a time when food was scarce. And if you don't eat everything now, you know, we don't know if we're going to have a lot of food for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I fight that with myself. Like, my kids are like, I'm not hungry. I don't want to eat anymore.
Yeah.
And I make sure that they don't eat shitty food instead, or because they snacked earlier. But if they don't want to eat, it's like, okay, then don't. But I mean, food is so abundant now. I don't need to stuff you full of food.
I know. That's such a crazy thing too, especially going through like fasting personally.
Yeah.
You know, you look at that and then you're like, well, they're kids and they need nutrients and, you know, they're growing and their mind's growing. And so they need nutrients. So as a parent, you look at them like, man, I need you to eat. I need you to eat. But like you said, I fight that all the time. Like, you know, no, they're full. They're satisfied. You know, we as a society, we overeat all the time.
Dude, my kids.
It's crazy.
They'll tell you when they're hungry.
They tell you.
This is a point that Sal brought up before that I think was such another great point when he talked about how you talk about food is to your kids, is also that, hey, do not be afraid if they're not hungry, they're not asking for it, don't feed them yet. Don't worry. In a couple hours, they'll let you know they're hungry.
They're not going to starve.
Yeah, they're not going to starve.
There was a few nights last week where, you know, or actually it was like a whole week long where my kids would barely eat dinner. And so I knew it was because they'd come home from school and then they'd eat snacks and my wife would give them like some cheese and some fruit and some nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, okay, well, the snacks aren't bad. However, for dinner, we're having, you know, things that I think they should be eating. So I cut snacks out. So I'd pick them up from school and they'd be like, I want a snack. I'd be like, no, we're going to wait till dinner. We'd have dinner a couple hours later. And of course, they'd eat, lo and behold, they'd eat their whole dinner.
They'd get hungry.
It's just one of those things. Yeah. You know? It's not rocket
science.
That's
it. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not torturing your kid. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Depriving them. Waiting for the actual meal. I know. That's the other thing. Practicing patience.
So all said and said, I think who's to blame? Parents, right?
Yeah.
It's nobody else's fault.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, we also determine the market, so
that's right.
Make it happen.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. For more information about this show and to get valuable free resources from Sal, Adam, and Justin, visit us at www.mindpumpradio.com. Until next time, this is Mind Pump.